supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In 6 days, Philadelphia voters will elect a new district attorney to replace Seth Williams. He's now serving a 5-year sentence after his guilty plea in a corruption case. Democrat Larry Krasner has a big edge in party registration, but he's such a harsh critic of the criminal justice system that Republican Beth Grossman thinks she has a shot at what would be an historic upset. We asked WHYY's Dave Davies to check in on the campaign. Here's his report.
Yes, there is a district attorney's campaign in Philadelphia. It's not as visible as the spring Democratic primary, when several candidates and billionaire George Soros were buying TV ads. But the candidates present a real choice. Democrat Larry Krasner's a defense attorney who says the justice system over-arrests and over-incarcerates, wasting money and destroying communities. Republican Beth Grossman is proud of her 21 years as a prosecutor and promises practical reforms. Both candidates are busy. Grossman stopped in recently at a Kensington Avenue Business Association meeting.
This neighborhood has a very special place in my heart. My parents owned a candy store at 3151 Kensington Avenue. I worked in that store during high school during my breaks. I bought my prom dress on the avenue at Linda Lee.
Grossman heard merchants tell horror stories of being at ground zero of the city's opioid epidemic. She talked about her experience in the DA's office and promised a new community engagement unit if she's elected. Could Grossman win? Well, here's the case. Her law and order message may appeal to older voters, including some Democrats, who historically turn out more than most age groups. She has the support of the police union, which has billboards touting her candidacy, and the firefighters union. And she got the endorsement of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Krasner says Democrats may outnumber Republicans by nearly 7-1, but he's taking nothing for granted.
Anybody can lose this race. You know, we have to take it incredibly seriously because we are talking about transformational change, and change is hard.
Krasner's keeping a full schedule of appearances and has volunteers canvassing areas where he has support. At a Palatin Business Association meeting this morning, he talked about more effective policing, including moving away from the controversial stop-and-frisk policy. Krasner said stop-and-frisk came from an attempt to focus on high-crime areas, but without clear constitutional guidelines, police stopped countless innocent people, creating an unhealthy rift between officers and communities.
And we end up in this world where it's now okay to have occupying armies in certain neighborhoods who stop people just because they are almost always male and young and poor and very often black and brown.
That's the kind of language that infuriates police union leaders and Republicans hope will drive away moderate voters. At a recent debate, Grossman said she agrees with Krasner that there should be bail reform, less incarceration, and programs to divert criminal cases into treatment and community service. But she said Krasner has spent his career defending criminals while she's been doing the work of a prosecutor.
When you stand up and you fight for victims, through kids who have been sexually assaulted, through victims who have been shot, and you get people convicted and they're properly punished, that's justice. So I hate to tell you, but the role of the DA's office is you have to prosecute.
Grossman may have a message, but she doesn't have much of a megaphone. She's struggled to raise money, and with only $16,000 on hand as of last week, she's not in a position to run ads telling voters about her Inquirer endorsement, for example. The last time a Republican won the DA's race in Philadelphia was 32 years ago, when a prosecutor named Ron Castile beat a weak Democratic candidate to win the office. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
A double murder 23 years ago rocked a community some 51 miles away from Philadelphia, just outside of Allentown. The following investigation, trial, conviction, and sentencing is chronicled in a book by Tammy Mall entitled Convenient Suspect, A Double Murder, A Flawed Investigation, and the Railroading of an Innocent Woman. Tammy Mall, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the events on Thursday, December 15th, 1994.
In Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, 26-year-old Joanne Katranek and her three-month-old son, Alex, vanished from their Catasauqua, Pennsylvania home. Her husband, Andy, came home from work about 6 that night. He wasn't worried at first because he knew Joanne had plans to go Christmas shopping.
With his mom.
With his mother, yes. And eventually he found out Joanne never showed up at his mother's house. A little later, he found that someone had broken into his basement door, and he ended up calling the police then. A little later after that, they found Joanne's car abandoned in a parking lot next door to her house. And still a little later after that, he found the phone line cut in his basement.
Andy, the husband and father, was initially the suspect. How did it come to be that that attention was diverted, and to who?
Actually, Andy was a suspect literally right up until the moment the bodies were found, which was 4 months later in April. And then suspicion focused on Andy's ex-girlfriend, Patricia Rohrer, who had rented a stable near where the bodies were found. So they started focusing on Patricia Rohrer. And then all of a sudden, Andy was no longer a suspect. And from everything I have looked at, I cannot see where they cleared Andy.
In fact, you focus on potential motives that would implicate Andy, including the deliberation over whether he was fertile.
Yes. When I interviewed the prosecutor in the case, he told me that that was how they cleared Andy, because they did do a paternity test and they found out that Alex was Andy's son. So therefore, the prosecutor, Mr. McIntyre, told me, you know, Andy had no motive to kill them. My thinking on that is Andy couldn't have known he was Alex's father until after the deaths. So what did he believe before? I don't know.
The jury evaluated testimony from more than 100 witnesses, 200 exhibits.
Yes.
And yet it took them 2 hours to come to conclusion.
2 hours.
What do you make of that?
I think Patricia Rohrer, in my opinion, was convicted long before she walked into that courtroom. She was so vilified that, you know, to most people there, her guilt was not even in question. I mean, I was the same way. When I started reading what the newspapers wrote and looking into the case, I was totally convinced of her guilt.
Even though the guilt was predicated on circumstantial evidence, the strongest of which was mitochondrial DNA evidence, and that whole science was new at the time.
It was brand new. Hers was the first criminal case in Pennsylvania that had mitochondrial DNA evidence in it.
One of the curiosities you raise is the demeanor of the husband and father, Andy, shortly thereafter. He seemed to some too cool, too calm, too collected. He did fail aspects of at least 2 polygraph tests. Though now let's talk about Patricia's demeanor as you encountered her. At that point, she had already served more than a decade in jail. How did she appear to you?
I expected her to look pretty bad after almost 20 years in prison, but she didn't. She's very attractive. You know, Patricia is a very distinct person. She's a large woman. She's tall. She's almost 6 feet. She towers over me. She's got very long hair. She has a southern accent. It kind of surprised me that no one had noticed her in Catasauqua stalking a woman for 3 days.
If there are no specific heroes or villains in this book, merely tragic victims, what system or systems come under indictment?
It would have to be how the police go about investigating crimes. The prosecutor, I think there was a lot of pressure on them to convict someone for these crimes. It was a horrible, horrible crime. I mean, whoever did it deserves to be in prison. And I'll be the first one to say, if Patricia Rohrer did it, she should stay in jail. But I don't think they had enough to convict her. I think there is serious doubt as to her guilt. I think when it comes to this kind of stuff, a review of the case is warranted.
What are the chances, though, of that happening at this juncture?
They're not good. We actually just heard from Superior Court this week, and they have denied her appeal.
The book is newly published. Have you closed the book on Patty, or are you still in touch with her?
I am still in touch with her. I consider her a friend at this point. We talk. I visit her. And I would like to see her case to the end. I mean, if it fails in every legal challenge and she's in prison, or if she does get released someday. I would like to see it through to the end. You know, it's very hard to turn your back on someone after you've, you know, come to the point where you think she probably is in there wrongfully convicted. How do you just say, okay, my book is done. We'll see ya.
Tammy Maugh, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Tammy Maugh, author of Convenient Suspect, A Double Murder, A Flawed Investigation, and The Railroading of an Innocent Woman. Pennsylvania is home to more hate groups than all but four states in the nation, tallying more than three dozen, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. In the past year or so, it seems those groups and their sympathizers have become more willing to make their biases public. Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall reports on how one such incident sparked a student from Montgomery County to take a stand.
16-year-old Erin Dunphy was admittedly curious when she recently sorted through the mail and came upon an envelope addressed to Proud American. But her curiosity soon turned to outrage once she opened it.
I found a really horrible illustration along with a swastika at the bottom. It basically depicted an African-American man holding a knife to the throat of a white businessman and was captioned with, "How do you like your multicultural America now?"
Dunphy, who's white, later learned that the letters were mailed to residents in three mostly white neighboring boroughs using personalized descriptions. The family with a lush garden got one mailed to Flower Power, and the family with a wrestling sign on their front lawn was Wrestler. Dunphy's family, who lives on a neat block of homes in northern Montgomery County, flies an American flag in front of their home, hence the Proud American label.
I was kind of frightened because, I mean, there are people, they had some very specific details about people. To know that whoever sent these basically stalked members of the community and kept a record of that, just kind of, it was scary.
Dunphy could have let her fear get the best of her, or she could have thrown the letter in the trash and just gotten ready for her Upper Perkiomen High School swim practice. Instead, she took action.
I decided to start a GoFundMe page called Stand Up to Hate in Upper Perk to try and raise as much money as possible so I could buy signs saying hate has no home here in several different languages and distribute them at no charge to anyone who wanted them.
Dunphy's dad, John Sackett, says his pride in Erin for taking a stand trumps his concern about her going public.
That kind of inclusion is exactly what I think our family's about and what we want our community to be about.
The Upper Perkiomen Police Department declined comment. The Anti-Defamation League says it hasn't been typical for hate groups to randomly target individual homes in Pennsylvania. But they say this action fits in with a larger recent pattern of hate messages becoming more visible and public. For instance, Nancy Barron Bear, director of the Philadelphia chapter of the ADL, says there's been 18 reported incidents of racist flyering on college campuses throughout Pennsylvania this year.
Often we see this kind of mailing or flyerings on college campuses because it is a way for just one individual or two individuals rather than a large group of people who are racist and bigoted being able to get their message across to large groups of people.
Dunphy wants to take her campaign national. She says the more hate groups come forward, the more people like her should make their dissent known.
This is not going to change the minds of whoever spread this mail, and I know that. But I think my goal here, you know, in the end, is really just to kind of show that as a people, we are not hateful. We are not here to spread malicious and spiteful messages. I think generally it's an accepting country, and I want it to stay that way.
Dunphy had originally hoped to raise $800 on her GoFundMe page, a mark that's now almost tripled. Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
Facebook, Google, and Twitter are in the hot seat as hearings in Washington focus on the role their technologies played in Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential elections. Helping us make sense of the proceedings is WHYY web producer Marilyn DeAngelo. Marilyn, we are focusing on the 2016 presidential elections, but there's a legacy that goes well beyond that.
So these things have been going on over the last several years. These fake news stories that many people had heard of, the severity and sophistication of this campaign really wasn't exposed and truly understood until just recently. And they're not quite going away yet. A lot of the campaigns that were found, which the tech companies are testifying about, have been targeting not just Republicans or Democrats, but pretty much everybody across the board.
To what extent were the companies complicit by at least omission?
It's $126 million on Facebook. They actually just in the last 24 hours uncovered a really large cache on Instagram. Google has its own issues that are connected to YouTube videos. They're actually being paid for shared ad revenue. This is propaganda, and it's been going on for years, and Russia, as well as other foreign actors, are partaking in it. And because the social media landscape is almost like the Wild Wild West, there is no oversight, there's no regulation. And when it comes to campaign spending, we require that no foreign dollars are spent on our campaign ads. Broadcast television and radio, everybody has rules. And because Facebook, Twitter, Google, because they're not considered media publishers, they haven't been abiding by these rules. They are still claiming that they are tech companies and that publishing is just a secondary. And as American companies, which the oversight committees have been very proud of, that these are American ingenuity, American brands, but Americans have to come first. And when you have foreign actors, in this case specifically Russia, that this is a serious risk. Senator Lindsey Graham actually called it the national security challenge of the 21st century.
What can consumers of this information do to get a better sense of what's real and what's not?
So there are promises by the tech companies to make the advertising much more transparent, to be able to click onto an icon and see who is advertising and what they are advertising for. But it is up to us as voters, as Americans, as Facebook users, to be smart about what we do.
So, Marilyn, how are you being smart about what you do on Facebook?
It's always a good idea to follow sites that are verified or people that you know. But sometimes you like a site because you thought it was funny or you followed something that you might not have realized was propaganda. So my suggestion, best practice, go in, check out the pages that you've liked in the past. Now, if you see a lot of stuff in there that seems spammy or strange, I'm not saying you have to stick with CNN or
NPR.
NPR, exactly. Even if it's Breitbart, even if it's Drudge, these are places that are at least legitimate journalism, broadcasts, places that we know there's real journalists behind, and we're not Russian propagandists. There's a lot of these unverified and spammy sites that you might not realize you have liked, and it's just good practice to clean out the closet every once in a while. You can also go to groups because sometimes you'll have been invited into a group, and whether or not you opted in, you were added. And so you might end up with some extra stuff there. Also, you can do a double check for yourself. Click on your recent ad activity, and then you can see which ads that you've clicked into. It does give you an idea about things that maybe you didn't realize was an ad. If you can at least see the things that you have clicked on and be a little bit more proactive moving forward.
Marilyn, I'd like to say thanks for joining us. This has been very sobering and edifying. Thank you for being here on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
WHYY web producer Marilyn DeAngelo on NewsWorks tonight. The Penn Museum is beginning a major overhaul, expected to cost tens of millions of dollars and taking years to complete. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the century-old museum wants to make the building easier on visitors and its artifacts.
The Harrison Auditorium and the Middle East Galleries at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology are now closed. They're included in the first phase of an overall transformation of the building's interior. The building is actually a network of seven structures that were built and interconnected over the course of a century. It can be confusing to navigate, hard to find a bathroom, and director Julian Sigger says it has never had real air conditioning.
But the interior is being dramatically redesigned with new lifts, new stairwells, new washrooms, new ways to walk around the building. The air conditioning, of course, is fairly profound. I mean, if you've been here in the summer, it can be rather challenging.
Among the changes will be wider hallways, more bathrooms, and that air conditioning system. Also, the palace of an ancient Egyptian pharaoh will be reconstructed in the high vaulted room on the third floor. Right now, the stone columns of that palace, each weighing about 15 tons, are in a lower room, and they're displayed in pieces because that room is not tall enough for them to reach their full height. The changes will allow museum curators to better store, study, and exhibit the museum's collection of artifacts. Sigger says part of the building's capital campaign is raising money for research and education. University President Amy Gutman says the overhaul will bring together the university's greatest attributes.
It is not just a place to discover skeletons that we want to take out of the closet. It is a place to show what those skeletons meant in human history and what our future may have in store because of our history.
The first phase of this transformation, the overhaul of the auditorium, Middle East, and Latin American galleries, will cost $21 million and take about a year and a half to finish. Subsequent phases have not yet been funded. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.